Welcome to episode 2 of the Panopticon podcast. This episode was recorded on March 23rd, 2010, and is titled Wilhelm Reich and the Orgonomy of Anarchism. This episode is about Wilhelm Reich, an Austrian psychologist who was born in 1897 and died in America in 1957. His field of research included the function of the orgasm, orgone energy, and the psychology of fascism. It is also about basic anarchist thought and philosophy, and how these two systems inform each other nicely, specifically in how it might be possible that a viable anarchist society or culture could thrive somewhere on our planet. The orgonomy of anarchism refers to the necessity of the harmonious relationships between all the organs of the organism and of the proper, natural, healthy circulation throughout that organism of the life energy, orgone, which Reich had discovered. This mirrors the necessity of harmonious relationships between individuals and groups in a hypothetical anarchist society. But if, quote, we all have a policeman inside our heads, quote, or a wannabe patriarch or dictator lurking behind the shadows of our psyches, the anarcho-syndicate or commune won't last long. Wilhelm Reich worked for a time along Sigmund Freud. In fact, he was thought by many to be the future successor to Freud as leader of the psychoanalytic movement in Europe. He revolutionized the field, although at its growing intransigence, through his work with the character, the body, and the orgasm. One of his most important discoveries, if not the most important, was that the universe is filled, non-locally, with a kind of life energy, which he called orgone energy. Freud had argued that there was a sexual energy called libido, which he initially described as, quote, something which is capable of increase, decrease, displacement, and discharge, and which extends itself over the memory traces of an idea, like an electric charge over the surface of the body. But by 1925, he had rejected the idea that it was a physical energy. Reich took the idea further, arguing that he had discovered a primordial cosmic energy. He called it orgone, and the study of it orgonomy. This primordial cosmic energy, orgone, is blue in color, he wrote, omnipresent, can be seen with the naked eye, and is responsible for such things as weather, the color of the sky, gravity, the formation of galaxies, and the biological expressions of emotion and sexuality. He argued that St. Elmo's fire is a manifestation of it, as is the blue color of sexually excited frogs, red corpuscles, plant chlorophyll, gonadal cells, protozoa, and cancer cells are all charged with orgone, he said. It expressed itself most immediately to us in the body, and the natural interior freedom or blocking up of that energy. By studying people's body movements and characters, their method of articulation down to their posture and mannerisms, Reich proposed that this character armor, as he called it, and its different blockages was a key into people's deep, semi, and unconscious problems. He distinguished several different character types, such as the hysterical, the compulsive, the phallic, narcissistic, and the masochistic characters. Orgone energy flows through the body, and it either circulates in a manner healthy to the organism or in a dammed up, rigidified manner, which is unhealthy to the person. In the process of orgasm, for instance, one can tell much about one's orgone blockage, as well as where and how rigid or loose one's body is. A person's ability to relax their body and experience pleasure, or whether they have regular free bowel movements, for instance, are keys to understanding the blockages and bound-up neuroses in one's character and self. These ideas are concisely explained in Reich's books The Function of the Orgasm, 1952, as well as Character Analysis, 1945, and The Sexual Revolution, 1945. Freud had proposed that our bodily and sexual instincts, in order for culture to exist, needed to be repressed and thereby somehow sublimated. It was the presence of the dark and mysterious unconscious contents which were the problem. However, for Reich, it was these very prohibitions, imposed externally or internally, of the free, natural expression of these instincts which make weak, sociopathic monsters out of some people. The idea is that we are compelled from birth to slowly construct what Reich called the character armor, in order to protect the parts of our character we are ashamed of and cut off from, usually out of deep, unconscious anxiety that the banished contents might be spotted. Until the root point of stasis, originating in the psyche, yet also contorting the actual body in some way, is reached and freed, the neuroses will continue in their harmful wrangling of the character. His system of character analysis was based on thousands of hours with patients and years of intensive study of the human organism. Freud and Jung focused on the depths of the unconscious and discovered much there, but they tended to limit themselves to the symbols of the unconscious, whereas Reich focused more on the way the patient would actually speak about these symbols. For Reich, quote, the manner in which the patient talks, in which he greets the analyst or looks at him, the way he lies on the couch, the inflection of the voice, the degree of conventional politeness, all these things are valuable criteria, end quote. He criticized his colleagues who would complain of not having any material to work with in a patient, or that they are not revealing anything which allows the analyst to analyze them. He said that, quote, the how of saying things is as important material for interpretation as is what the patient says. The manner in which the patient keeps quiet or his sterile repetitions are also material which can and must be put to use, end quote. This logic turns every social experience into a chance to understand the mechanisms of psyche or self and its relationship to visible character traits, as well as the physical organism itself, amongst individuals or groups of individuals. Reich was courageous enough to state that unless people were experiencing orgasm naturally, in a healthy and consistent fashion, then certain physical issues arise, the most frequently observed being constipation. He would touch his patients' chests and legs and sometimes have them sit in their underwear through the session. He proposed the existence of an emotional plague, a, quote, epidemic disease, like schizophrenia or cancer, with this important difference. It manifests itself essentially in social living, end quote. The effects of the emotional plague are what we suffer through psychologically and physically. It gives rise to the sadism, deceit, destructive nature of our species. The emotional plague manifests as wars, domestic violence, any kind of domination or coercion that can occur between people. We sometimes derive some kind of pleasure out of hurting others with words or fists because we are infected with this plague, which operates on fear, guilt, and shame. The instincts in an armored person meet the armor and wish to go out past it to the outside world. However, crashing into that barrier are mangled and twisted, thus barring an armored person to experience love and pleasure to the extent that we as organisms need to be healthy. Where do these blockages come from? Usually from the control mechanisms of those who shaped us during our formidable years. The hierarchical structure of the home can be just as fascistic or dictatorial as that of any state or government. Punishing a child for masturbating, for instance, is highly damaging to the child's development, as it quickly affiliates the sexual impulse, natural, healthy, and necessary on its own, with fear and punishment. Thus, the child might find it must hide or suppress its natural tendency to experience its own sexuality, and a whole host of problems result, such as sadistic impulses, premature ejaculation, impotence, frigidity, etc. From this shame, the young adult either succumbs to the fear and rigidifies himself into an unfeeling, unemotional person with no connection to his body, or tries to counteract that shame by immersing himself compulsively in the activities which now cause it, thus inflaming the wound even more. We see this in the reaction of, for instance, those who were raised in a very puritanical and sheltered fire and brimstone type of environment when first encountering red light districts and porno magazines. In fact, those phenomena exist through the exploitation of this very cancer in our social system. As an antidote to this plague, Reich developed what he called the self-governing character, whose inner drives are enabled to naturally actuate themselves without the need for repression or rules. The self-governing character, as he called it, is unarmored, and therefore in a position to understand the universe or the whole world of the senses functionally. Thinking and speaking functionally was a field in of itself for Reich. Ergonomy rests upon the basis of functionalism, a, quote, method of thinking and working, which becomes a dynamically progressive force of social development only by observing, criticizing, and changing mechanistic, mystical civilization from the standpoint of the natural laws of life, and not from the narrow perspective of state, church, economy, culture, etc. The living human animal acts like any other animal, functionally. Armored man acts mechanistically and mystically. Ergonomic functionalism is the vital expression of the unarmored human animal, his tool for comprehending nature. End quote. Wilhelm Reich was an Austrian of Jewish descent who was growing up, living, and working in World War I and post-World War I Germany during the massive rise in public support for National Socialism, which saw the election of Hitler to be Chancellor of Germany in January of 1933. This was the same year which saw the first edition of Reich's juggernaut, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, an exegetical exploration of the social, cultural, sexual, and nationalistic trends existent then in Germany, which provided such a massive powder keg for a spark like the Führer. As a psychotherapist throughout this whole time, from the Treaty of Versailles to World War II, Reich was in a particularly candid position to see the behind-the-scenes inner life of the psychological landscape of interwar Germany. He never attempted to steer clear of political critique and activism. He was kicked out of the Communist and then the Socialist parties of Austria, both times for publishing on his orgasm theory. After having been labeled a, quote, pornographic Jew by the Nazis, he narrowly made it out of Germany, disguised as a tourist going skiing in Switzerland. He was pursued with even more fervor by the United States government, although the charges which finally put him in jail in 1957 were for practicing with an expired license. He refused to even attend the trial. His heart attack in the New York prison occurred, amazingly, the day before he was to go up for parole. There are countless other amazing discoveries of Reich in the social sphere as well as the hard sciences, such as his Cloudbuster, a machine using orgone energy which successfully brought rain to a rural town in Maine, which had been in the middle of a drought. But for our purposes, this has been enough of an introduction of Reich's work and ideas. Now it is time to look at the orgonomy of anarchism. To start to crack the nut of the matter, it is the political implications of Reich's self-governing character model, specifically as it relates to anarchism and anarchist political theory, which it is the purpose of this paper to present. Deliberately or unwittingly, Reich developed a healthy, ideal psychological, physical, and sexual model for the individual, which has a remarkable affinity with the basic ostensible prerequisites for an anarchist culture. The self-governing character model could potentially preclude or make unnecessary the problems barring the establishment of communities without governments and hierarchies. Anarchism is a political system which offers as its ideal the concept that humans naturally thrive the most in communities and societies without hierarchical structures or institutional coercion of any sort. Its most modern forms originate in Western Europe, largely as a result of the tide of problems caused by the Industrial Revolution, amongst the same turmoil which saw the rise of communism and socialism. It has many faces, facets, and convictions, but namely, it is opposition to any authority which prohibits us from ordering and maintaining our own culture freely. The many anarchists remembered most by history were Pierre Joseph Proudhon, who first used the term anarchism in his Property is Theft, Peter Kropotkin, who responded to Darwin's theory of evolution with his book Mutual Aid, A Primary Factor in Evolution, in which he advocated that cooperation, just as often as competition, was a primary function of evolution. Emma Goldman, the Russian immigrant to the U.S., who lived with and advocated the justice owing American prostitutes and women everywhere, calling marriage legal prostitution, is another. Anarchism necessitates that each individual be self-governing. If they are not, they will need a government to keep them in line. It's really very simple. If I wish to live in a society without the infrastructure and bureaucracy, the lumbering hypocrisy of government, I must be prepared to choose not to steal or do anything else harmful or coercive to my fellow human. I must also be willing to mediate and deal with the issues which affect my community in a sane, rational, and constructive way. I must care about my neighbor as much as myself. Emma Goldman, in her essay called Anarchism, wrote that it is, quote, the teacher of the unity of life, not merely in nature, but in man. There is no conflict between the individual and the social instincts, any more than there is between the heart and the lungs, end quote. The statement is true according to my convictions. However, without doing the kind of work which Reich proposed, such as working to become a self-governing character, there will exist conflicts between the individual and the social instincts. This is one example of how Reich's ideas inform anarchism. Many early and contemporary anarchists and other pioneers of freedom idealized a social system wherein didn't exist police batons or criminality. There were many practical models offered, such as Rudolf Rocker's anarcho-syndicalism. However, none that I have found touched on the fundamental germs within individual human beings which give rise to fascism and authoritarianism. Reich, a doctor and psychoanalyst, found that germ and offered highly practical means of eliminating it. In an essay explaining anarchism in his newspaper The Blast, the late American anarchist Alexander Berkman says that, quote, anarchists hold life as the most sacred thing. That's why they want to change the present order of things, where everyone's hand is against his brother, and where war, wholesale slaughter, and the pursuit of the dollar, bloodshed in the field, factory and workshop is the order of the day. The poverty, misery, and bitter industrial warfare, the crimes, suicides, and murder committed every day of the year in this country will convince any man of intelligence that in present society we have plenty of law, but mighty little order or peace. End quote. The inherent practical problem which anarchism and other libertarian, egalitarian political systems have always faced is that when people are forced to live in authoritarian or coercive cultures, be it in the home, nation, or both, they tend to become infected with the germ of the emotional plague. which grows into a vicious, petty little tyrant within us. If you let loose the guard on these monsters, we have riots, looting, and carnage. And the reason might be this. We tend to revere the authority figures which have some kind of control over us, or who symbolize the structures which control us. These types have always been generals, heads of state, emperors, warriors. Because, as is obvious to anyone without their head buried in the ground, we live in a deeply patriarchal, control-worshipping culture, where the strong tend to win and the weak tend to lose. So what kind of strength and what kind of liberty does the anarchist speak of? The Russian anarchist Mikhail Bakunin answers, quote, "I am a fanatic lover of liberty, considering it as the unique condition under which intelligence, dignity, and human happiness can develop and grow. Not the purely formal liberty conceded, measured out, and regulated by the state, an eternal lie which represents nothing more than the privilege of some founded on the slavery of the rest. No, I mean the only kind of liberty that is worthy of the name, liberty that consists in the full development of all of the material, intellectual, and moral powers that are latent in each person. Liberty that recognizes no restrictions other than those determined by the laws of our own individual nature, which cannot properly be regarded as restrictions, since these laws are not imposed by any outside legislator, outside or above us, but are immanent and inherent, forming the very basis of our material, intellectual, and moral being. They do not limit us, but are the real and immediate conditions of our freedom." End quote. As we can see from this quote alone, anarchism is not the political theory for the weak, the ignorant, the lazy, or the apathetic. It is not for those who need to be told how to think, act, live, talk, or work. It is for those of us who are self-governing, and those of us who truly aspire to be self-governing, who wish to organize our own communities the way we want them to be, who will to shatter and reconstruct from the ashes of our decimated global environment a novel, life-affirming, spontaneous, creative, compassionate, natural order. We have now covered a psychophysical model of cognition and being, ergonomy, which places importance on the balanced flow of energy throughout the different organs and glands of the body, the most detrimental of them being the genitals. The self-governing character is one whose organs and glands are working harmoniously in his organism, who is aware of and capable of attaining healthily his needs, psychological, physical, and therefore socially, creatively, and spiritually. One who is self-governed in Reich's sense is that being who is able to interact and co-evolve with one, his fellow humans, in the most constructive, healthy, and positive way. The thirst and hunger for war and domination of another person or group of people issues from the rigidified stasis of orgone energy in different parts of the body. This creates anxiety, uncertainty, and fear, which bar us from healthy, vulnerable feelings and experiences, desensitizes us to basic human emotions and activities. Thus we become roboticized, internally frustrated, fractured, and increasingly in search of jingoistic or violent distractions. The outcome of our true intentions become thwarted by the character armor, through which they must pass in order to reach the outside world. They become disfigured, perhaps criminal, often nasty. Only an armored person could steal and lie to others. They are immune, in a sense, to these things themselves through their own defensive engineering, the armor. In a passage which acutely resembles anarchist thinking, Reich writes that the armored person, quote, "perceives the self as consisting of isolated parts. Every impulse must penetrate the armor. From this, the feeling of you should and you must arises, as well as the idea that the organism has a higher center that gives orders to the executive organs. In addition, there is the sensation of heaviness, inertia, or even paralysis in the limbs and the torso, which gives credence to the idea that an organ must act and be moved by an order." In other words, the organs are self-directing, in a sense, and exist on their own, ideally harmoniously, because they all have their own unique job and mode of expression in the body. The body is dynamic. It is an interdependent holistic system which hangs onto little which is of no use for it. The liver, the heart, lungs, and genitals all have a presence and, in their manifold working parts, an interiority and a purpose. The ideal is to allow them to expand and contract according to natural processes and needs, without the stern tasking of the character armor, overlording them according to its base needs of fear, guilt, and shame. In The Function of the Orgasm, Reich notes that a person, quote, brought up in an atmosphere which negates life and sex acquires a pleasure anxiety, end quote, finding its way through the organism in the form of chronic muscular spasms and other psychosomatic afflictions. This pleasure anxiety, then, is the, quote, soil on which the individual recreates the life-negating ideologies which are the basis of dictatorships. In the same essay, he says that, quote, the character structure of man today, who is perpetuating a patriarchal authoritarian culture some 4,000 to 6,000 years old, is characterized by an armoring against nature within himself and against social misery outside himself. This armoring of the character is the basis of loneliness, helplessness, craving for authority, fear of responsibility, mystical longing, sexual misery, of impotent rebelliousness, as well as of resignation. Human beings have taken a hostile attitude towards that in themselves which is living and have alienated themselves from it. End quote. Again, it is these words and ideas which have been curiously absent from the corpus of anarchist literature that I have seen. We cannot have a healthy collective, syndicate, commune, or even info shop that is made up of unhealthy, power-seeking individuals. We know what is wrong in the outside world, the bombs tearing apart innocence, economic strangulation, and militaristic control of most of our species. But we should also recognize and realize the individual as the primum foci of all social endeavor and strive for freedom from internal warfare and neuroses. It is this character armor which slowly builds and puffs itself up like a dictator with extended arm over the masses, over those who we try to control or fantasize of controlling, overtly or with the most polished delicacy. There was a saying affiliated with the psychoanalytic movement from the 60s, such as occurred at Esalen and Millbrook, which said that, quote, there is a policeman inside all our heads, and he must be destroyed, end quote. It is this timely, profound, chain-shattering idea of individual freedom, of mind, body, emotions, and spirit, which Reich gave inspired voice to. Another similarity of principle between orgonomy and anarchism is the idea that women should never be economically dependent upon men, and that the exploitation of women's sexuality for the selling of vices or commercial products is abhorrent, that marriage should never occur as a means of securing a necessary and convenient traditional financial relationship for those involved and their families, that the sexuality of women could be subjugated to the needs of the social sphere is an age-old leitmotif. Levi Strauss covered this extensively with his theories of the origin of the trading of women and bride price and dowry among uncivilized peoples. However, in our civilized culture, quote-unquote, the practice merely demands the auspice of approval from judge and priest, and it is officially safe, clean, and sanctified by the ostensibly most sacred authorities in the land. Reich realized after decades of therapy with thousands of patients that this sort of dependence, validated only by a piece of paper, wherein women were forced by the agreement to endure years of unfulfilled sexual stasis, loveless marriages, and as many more bringing children to the family, leads to huge problems. Again, Reich was living and working in Austria and Germany when he was gathering thousands of hours of therapy with that upper to middle class. The culture and time in which he was working out the function of the anarchism and the mass psychology of fascism was during the same time, almost exactly, that the Nazis garnered enough popularity to come to take power over Germany, later Poland, Czechoslovakia, France, and half of Scandinavia. The family structure in this culture, according to Reich, was itself fascist. Women had, especially in the upper classes of society, very little influence over politics, their vocation or education, or their bodies. He describes the findings of his therapy with women who had lived for years with an, quote, unloved man, who had suffered the sexual act as a marital duty, and who were unable finally to do so. They went on strike, would have no more. What could I say against it? It was at variance with all the accepted views, such as the one that a wife, as a matter of course, has to grant her husband sexual satisfaction as long as the marriage lasts, whether she wants to or not, whether she loves him or not, whether she is aroused or not. The ocean of lies in this world is deep. End quote. Generally, the anarchist view on this issue would be that women must be able to choose their own work, their own knowledge, their own experiences, their own sexuality and romances. These decisions should not be made on the grounds of satisfying tradition or the desires of family and friends, nor on economic convenience and security. A woman should never be forced into a position where she is subservient to or dependent on a man, any more than a man should be on a woman. Or a man with another man, or a woman with another woman. If women and men have the absolute freedom to choose their own work, art, craft, or skill, regardless of finances at all, we would not have this horrible phenomenon of the cubicle drone, commuters, Marcuse's one-dimensional man, briefcase in hand, and finances bearing heavily on the loins. In her essay, The Traffic in Women, Emma Goldman wrote, quote, of course, marriage is the goal of every girl, but as thousands of girls cannot marry, our stupid social customs condemn them either to a life of celibacy or prostitution. Human nature asserts itself regardless of all laws, nor is there any plausible reason why nature should adapt itself to a perverted conception of morality. Society considers the sex experiences of a man as attributes of his general development, while similar experiences in the life of a woman are looked upon as a terrible calamity, a loss of honor, and of all that is good and noble in a human being. This double standard of morality has played no little part in the creation and perpetuation of prostitution. It involves the keeping of the young in absolute ignorance on sex matters, which alleged innocence, together with an overwrought and stifled sex nature, helps to bring about a state of affairs that our Puritans are so anxious to avoid or prevent. End quote. That final sentence reflects Reich's work, such as summarized in his The Sexual Revolution and his The Invasion of Compulsory Sex Morality, which were both concerned primarily with these problems. It was this work which found squeamishness and repulsion in the many echelons of the Viennese Psychoanalytic Society in which Reich worked, as well as the Nazi Party. As Reich once said, love, work, and knowledge are the wellsprings of our life, and they should also govern it. So does the global desperation for individual freedom and real liberty. A novel, free, creative, healthy, natural morality should also govern our characters and the actions we will and the dreams we seek to bring to fruition.